Right, good. Okay. A couple of questions as we start the class. How many of you have ever heard of the two books doctrine of the Belgic Confession? Okay, a few of you. What is the two books doctrine? Right. Article 2, the Belgic Confession, God's given us two books of revelation, the book of Scripture and the book of nature. That implies that if you're a follower of Jesus Christ, you're commanded to be a theologian. We're commanded to study the book of nature, or the book of Scripture. That also means that you're commanded to be a scientist, or to study the book of nature. So I'm a professional scientist, but we're all scientists. We're all commanded to study the book of nature. We're all commanded to study the book of Scripture. It's not just the pastors that are the theologians. We're all theologians. Now, some of you have already been asking why I put up this slide here. It's basically to bring back some post-traumatic stress of your geology class that you took. But this is actually a segue to an incredible discovery that was announced the day after Valentine's Day. Some paleontologists in Idaho came up with an incredible announcement. Got the paper right here, and it's publicly available. Most research papers, you got to pay $25 to $35 to read the paper. This one they decided to make available free. So you can actually read the entire paper at your leisure. Now, to take it back to your geology class that you took in high school, why these divisions? I mean, these are all the eras and periods of geological history for the last half billion years, but you notice they're all divided up into these little boxes. What's responsible for dividing one geologic period from another geologic period, or a geologic era from another geologic era?
It's usually some geologic disaster.
Correct. These lines represent geologic disasters. And so after each disaster, you get a new kind of life that replaces the life that existed before. And from a biblical perspective, why do we need geologic disasters about once every 30 million years? And that's about how frequently they happen. About every 30 million years is a major disaster that wipes out anywhere from 25 to 95% of all the species of life on planet Earth. From a biblical perspective, okay, let me start with this. Where in the Bible do you get some support for this idea that there's going to be many creations of life? We actually studied it a few months ago. Pardon me? No, not the flood. The flood's one, yes. Yeah, Psalm 104. How many remember our little study in Psalm 104? That was like a year ago, right? They were in Psalm 104. As you get to the end of Psalm 104, what does it say? Verses 29, 30, and 31 makes the point that it's the property of all life to die off. Whatever species of life God creates, it will eventually die and go extinct. But what happens after that? He renews and recreates. And so that's how Psalm 104 ends, making the point that God's in the business of taking life away from the earth and replacing it with new life. And he does that repeatedly. And actually, paleontology documents that indeed is what happens. And you could go back way before this. This is just the last half billion years where we got the most detailed fossil evidence that indeed we're seeing. Life thrive on the earth with very little disturbance. Then you get a geologic disaster that wipes it out. And then thereafter, we get a replacement with different species of life. Now, for those of you who have been with the class for the last year or two, from a biblical perspective, why would God do this? A couple of things we got from our study in Psalm 104. For one, it's necessary to account for the changing brilliance of the sun. You may have noticed, those of you who have lived more than a few decades, that the sun's getting brighter and brighter as every year goes by. Well, really, you don't. It took 3.8 billion years for the sun to get 19% brighter. So it's a very gradual increase in brightness. Nevertheless, life can only tolerate about a 1% change. And so there's a need from God's perspective of wanting to pack the planet with as much life as possible for as long as possible to do something in order to take into account the brightening of the sun. And life plays one of the primary roles. Depending what life you have on planet Earth, it's going to chemically change the atmosphere in such a way that as the sun gets brighter and brighter, our atmosphere becomes less and less efficient in its capacity to trap heat from the sun. Right now, the chemistry of our atmosphere adds 33 degrees centigrade to the temperature of the surface of the Earth. So if it wasn't for our atmosphere, we'd be 33 degrees centigrade colder. And you can convert that to Fahrenheit. That means that today, for example, we'd be way below freezing. So the planet would be so cold, it'd be nothing but a huge ice ball. Matter of fact, the planet becomes an ice ball if you drop the temperature above 4 degrees centigrade from where it is right now. We're quite close to being an ice ball. So that 4 degree centigrade is all you need, and 33 degrees. Yes?
So all the talk about global warming that we're hearing mm-hmm. is very politicized. Is that a normal occurrence?
Well, what I'm going to share with you today is a discovery about the greatest global warming event in the history of our planet, where the temperature rose. Well, I'll get to it, I'll tell you. It rose by a lot. So,
what's the name of the paper, please?
I'll get to that in a second. Okay, we'll get there. So you can all check it out. So, because the sun is getting brighter and brighter, it's necessary that God take life away from the planet and replace it with new life that more efficiently changes the chemistry of the atmosphere to trap less heat. And, we've heard about global warming. What is it that's in the atmosphere that works to trap heat? Okay, carbon dioxide, I'm sure you've heard of that one. That's the one that's always being talked about. But carbon dioxide is not the dominant factor in our atmosphere that warms the planet. Water vapor is the primary factor that's warming our planet. Carbon dioxide, actually I think nitrogen is next. So it's water first, nitrogen, then carbon dioxide, and then methane. Those are the primary gases. There are other gases too that help to warm the planet. But what you see over this history of Earth is God taking life away from the planet and replacing it with new life that draws down carbon dioxide and draws down methane and therefore traps less heat. And so as the sun's getting brighter and brighter, God is able to sustain an abundance of planet throughout the entire history of our Earth back to the origin of life 3.825 billion years ago. Now, notice that we human beings are at the very end of this. We're right up there at the end of the quaternary period. And the benefit of being at the end is what? We get a big benefit by showing up at the very end. Yes?
Wasn't God's goal to do all of this for us, like you say, for man and for technology and that we can live and et cetera? So we had to have all of these things happen for that.
Right. And what are all these things that 3.8 billion years of life gives us?
All the Permian is, all these extinctions, all of this, the moon, the oxygen, the water, all of those things.
All of those things and?
Fossil fuels.
Yes. Okay. A lot of you probably got here with an automobile, right?
Yeah.
Well, the gasoline that you burn, it came from the Devonian. There was one period where a lot of that was drawn down. Carboniferous is where a lot of the coal was. So during these past periods, a lot of our fossil fuels were laid down. Now, as you were driving here, you probably drove at least partway on a freeway. Okay, what's the basis of the pavement of the freeway? Concrete. Okay, what's the primary ingredient of concrete? Broken up seashells. So, calcium carbonate. And the calcium carbonate comes from all this life that preceded us. In fact, the dominant biodeposit in the crust of the earth is limestone. So it makes up about 98% of all the biodeposits in the crust of the earth. And it's because of all those carbonates in the crust of the earth laid down by life that's been here for billions of years that we're able to build cities and freeways. It's also thanks to all this life that we have metals that we can mine. Because before the Cambrian, I mean, we had 3 billion years of life before the Cambrian. And a lot of that were bacteria that were processing the metals of planet Earth. And so if you go back to the very origin of life, our planet was filled with all these metals, mainly in soluble form. And that would have been poisonous to animals. There's a reason why you don't get animals until here. Because the chemistry of the Earth was deadly. It was toxic to animals before that. It took 3 billion years of bacterial activity to chemically transform the metal environment of the Earth to make it safe for animals. And one of the benefits is that these bacteria were processing all these soluble metals and putting them into insoluble form, which means we have valuable ores that we can mine. So, for example, there would be zinc mines, chromium mines, and that's all been processed thanks to primarily bacteria. Yes?
Sir, I'm a little bit confused. It wouldn't be the first time. I believe last week you told me after class that there's a period called the Avalon period.
Yes.
How long did that last, and were there animals during that time? I thought there were.
Yes. The Avalon is immediately before the Cambrian. I didn't put that on here, but yeah, you're right. The first animals that show up on planet Earth, at least the first that are not microscopic, are the Avalon animals. And they begin at 575 million years ago. Okay. And for the first 3 billion years of life on planet Earth, there was at most 3% oxygen in the atmosphere. And that was just for a tiny narrow window of time. Most of the time it was 1% or less. And that's not enough to sustain animal life. Avalon explosion is where the oxygen goes from 1% to 8%. Now you've got enough oxygen for animals, and you have animals on the face of the Earth. But the Avalon animals are different from the Cambrian animals in that the Cambrian animals have skeletons. They have either shells or internal skeletons, and they've got complex organs. The Avalon animals didn't have a digestive tract. There's no mouth, there's no anus, there's no digestive tract. They didn't have eyes. But the Cambrian animals did. Why? Because what happened at 543 million years ago, the oxygen jumped from 8% to 10%. And now you got enough oxygen that you can have these complex animals.
Would you say the Cambrian explosion was during that whole Cambrian period, or the beginning of it? Or?
Well, for a long time, paleontologists were convinced there was a gradual introduction of the phyla, animal phyla, throughout the Cambrian. Yeah, maybe one at the beginning and then they graduate. But now they're realizing they all show up at the beginning.
The whole ecosystem, right?
All the eye designs are right there at the beginning. You even got what you have, three compartment brains, which is the brain structure of birds and mammals.
Wow.
They're right there at the beginning.
Yeah.
Everything happens right at the beginning.
That's really proof of creation. there were plants that in that ecosystem that pre-existed? Or?
Plants? On the other hand, plants don't fossilize as easily as animals. Animals have skeletons,
yeah.
And so they're well preserved. They do have plant fossils here, but they're parts. They're not whole plants. In fact, the biggest is literally just millimeters across.
My question is, did they pre-exist?
There is evidence that plants pre-existed. In fact, there's now evidence that they pre-existed by at least 600 million years. But again, all we have are fossil parts. In fact, the biggest part previous to the Cambrian is literally 1 millimeter. That's the biggest plant fossil we have. Yes.
So when we read the Genesis 1 account, which did that come from? Which era?
Okay. Creation day 3, it says, let there be vegetation on the continental land masses. And it's a generic term referring to any plant that, any life form that undergoes photosynthesis. It could even refer to the microscopic life forms. That's creation day 3. Creation day 4 is when the atmosphere gets transformed, where for the first time it becomes transparent, at least on occasion. So that creatures could actually see the position of the sun, moon, and stars, let them serve to be signs to mark seasons, days, and years, verse 14 and verse 15. Plants don't need that, but animals do. When you get to creation day 5, that's the first mention of animals in the Genesis 1 text. And it begins by saying, let the seas swarm with these small sea animals. And that's what we see in the Avalon and Cameron explosions. It's all marine life. You don't see animals at this point on the continents. You do once you get into this these eras. But yeah, the first animals are marine animals. And yeah, they explosively show up. I mean, you go from microscopic life forms to animals that are literally 2 meters across. I mean, you get my book, Improbable Planet, I actually give you a whole page of quotes from paleontologists as they study this, basically saying, you know, these animals, they just literally explode out of nowhere with no evolutionary history. And it happens the moment that the oxygen permits them to exist. But that's not what I'm here to talk about today. I'm here to talk about the greatest of the extinction events. And say, each of these lines marks a geologic catastrophe. I'll add this, however. It's roughly every 30 million years you get a geological catastrophe. It's now recognized in the scientific literature that it's a geologic catastrophe that's initiated by an astronomical catastrophe. And it's such that the Earth orbits about the center of our galaxy. But as it orbits about the center of our galaxy, not only is it going around the disk of the galaxy, it's oscillating up and down relative to the plane of the galaxy. And one of the amazing design features of our solar system, it hardly moves up and down. Most stars move up and down by a lot. And here's the problem. You've got this Milky Way, I should have a slide for this, but I don't. Okay, so you've got this Milky Way galaxy and its disk, and in the very middle of the disk, you've got thick dust, and that dust blocks out radiation from the supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy. The center of our galaxy, there's a black hole of about 3 to 4 million masses, solar masses. Not as big as other galaxies. One of the design features of our galaxy, a large spiral galaxy with a small supermassive black hole. Other galaxies haven't come in as high as 10 billion times the mass of the sun. Ours is only 3 or 4 million times the mass of the sun. So as you go home tonight, you can thank God for the fact that we've got a relatively small supermassive black hole. It pours out deadly radiation. And most stars get exposed to that radiation as they go around the center of the galaxy because of their up and down movement. When you go up, you get exposed. When you go down, you get exposed. You stay in the plane, you're protected. And one of the features of our solar system is our star, the sun, goes up and down like this, where most stars go up and down like this. So we don't go up and down very much. We do go up and down enough, however, that it does have an impact on this, in the sense that as you pass through the very center of the disk, as you go through that dense part, what it does, it disturbs the Oort cloud of comets. That's the biggest cloud of comets that's orbiting about our solar system. It's roughly like 0.5 trillion to 2 trillion miles away from the sun, but it's got loads of comets and asteroids in it. And as you pass through the plane of the galaxy, that gets disturbed and you get bombardment. And there's been a major debate going on in the geological community as to what exactly is responsible for each of these mass extinction events that happen here. And for a long time, the consensus was it's driven by volcanic eruptions, massive volcanic eruptions. And you do see that. The really big mass extinction events, there are huge volcanic eruptions. What's now recognized is it takes a big asteroid or comet collision with the Earth to stimulate that volcanic eruption. And in the case of the biggest of these mass extinction events, supervolcanoes were already erupting. And then you got a collision event, and what it does is it causes these volcanic eruptions to basically balloon up by about a factor of 1,000 times. And so you get a major disaster. Okay, the one we're talking about is what's called the Permian Triassic. So it's right here or right here. This is the border 252 million years ago. They can't exactly find the crater that was responsible. After all, we're talking 250 million years ago. The geology of the Earth is very effective at erasing crater evidence. The best crater evidence we have for a major collision event where we got really good data, it's only 100 million years old. And it's basically in the middle of Quebec. You can see a huge crater there, about 100 kilometers in diameter. But they think they have found the collision event that was responsible for the Permian Triassic disaster. It's in Antarctica, under a whole lot of ice, and has been heavily eroded. And so it's not as distinct as a piece of evidence as they would like. But what that did is it caused the volcanic eruptions that were already taking place just before the end of the Permian event to multiply up. How much? It was such that the volcanic eruptions that took place after the Antarctic impactor hit to explode out so much lava, it adds up to the equivalent of 20 feet of lava over the entire surface of the Earth. Continents, oceans, everything. So it's the biggest volcanic eruption that's ever happened in the history of the Earth. So this will give you an idea of what happened when this event took place. It's the greatest global warming event that took place. Temperature going from 21 degrees centigrade up to 35 degrees centigrade. And this being the United States of America, I need to convert that to Fahrenheit for you, okay? So 21 degrees centigrade is equivalent to 70 degrees Fahrenheit. And the 35, that's 95 degrees Fahrenheit. And that's referring to the temperature of the ocean. The average temperature of the ocean today is in the high 50s. So we're talking about the ocean water going from the high 50s up to 95 degrees. So that's by far the biggest global warming event ever.
So the lava did cover the oceans?
Well, the total amount of lava would add up to 20 feet over the entire surface of the Earth, but parts of the Earth were much heavily covered with lava than other parts. And so Siberia, for example, had the heaviest coating of lava. But dust covered the whole Earth. And with that much volcanic eruption, you're going to get dust and ash in the atmosphere that's so intense, it stops photosynthesis, which means the animals have got nothing to eat. So it explains why there was such a mass extinction. Yes?
When the sun is up and down and then
to the plane of the galaxy, yes.
What's the connection to the Oort cloud?
Okay. As it goes through the very center of the plane, it's getting exposed to supermassive stars and especially dense molecular clouds. The highest density of stars and clouds is going to be right in the plane. If you're above the plane or below the plane, you're not being so exposed. But yeah, those dense molecular clouds gravitationally disturb the comets, and cause a whole bunch of them to rush in towards the inner solar system.
That's our question here, but is there some resonance that causes this up and down?
Well, it's typical for all stars that go around the galaxy. I mean, all stars revolve around the galaxy, just like all planets revolve around the sun. And every one of them manifests a sinusoidal up and down movement as it goes around. Now, they all have different periods. For our star, the period is, they think it's about 32 to 33 million years. They're still trying to get some greater precision on that. But what's interesting is that that periodicity matches what we see in the...
Actually, on the sixth part of the mesozoic, only one is about 38 million. The others were like 40 to 50 million.
Okay. I can show you another slide. It's actually in the Improbable Planet, where they actually show you hundreds of mass extinction events, all of different kinds. And yeah, there is some variation because it's not an exact sinusoid as we go around the center of our galaxy. So sometimes we, the period is like 29 million years and then go up to about 35 million years. So there is some variation in how frequently these happen. And yeah, some of these mass extinction events aren't as severe as others. And so when you get close to a really big molecular cloud, it's going to cause a problem. And some of these molecular clouds are a little bit above the plane and below the plane. So it explains why you don't get an exact periodicity. But it's close. I mean, for about a 10-year period, there was a debate in the scientific literature. Is there a correlation or is there not? And part of the problem was the astronomers were having difficulty measuring, when do we come into contact with these giant molecular clouds? And then also the geologists were having difficulty trying to date when all these events took place. And it took about a 10-year period before they had accurate enough data on both sides to say the correlation's real. But I can remember 10 years ago where people were saying, we don't think there's a correlation. It's just chance. But now that they got better dates on both sides, there is a consensus, we are seeing a correlation. Is it extremely tight? No, but the correlation is real. So, okay, yes.
How big was the thing that fell, or the meteor or whatever? And if it went all over the oceans, what does that do to the water? Do you still get rock? How does that work?
Okay, we got really good data. Let me take you back to, the one that people really know about is the one that ended the Cretaceous period. Okay, that's one that gets all the publicity. Because we actually see the crater in the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico. And the reason why is it's only 66 million years ago. So this Antarctic thing, they're not even sure where the crater is. Well, what they have known about the Permian-Triassic catastrophe is that one of the big effects was all this lava being poured out by supervolcanoes that were predominantly in Siberia. So you refer to them as the Siberia traps. And they've actually been able to determine how much lava, but the whole point is what triggered that volcanic eruption of that magnitude, and the thinking... Well, yeah, because we're talking too far back in time. And it's Antarctica. Antarctica is covered with thousands of feet of ice. And that ice is actually erasing a lot of the information we would like. So that's not settled yet. But there is good data on just how catastrophic the event was. As I said, it caused the sea temperature to jump up. And when you have the temperature of the ocean jump up by that much, obviously the sea level is going to rise up because you're going to be melting all the ice on planet Earth. But when you warm the ocean by that much, every degree you warm the ocean, you get a drop in the oxygen content. In fact, that's a worry today from people looking at the climate of the Earth, is that the planet is warming up, and that means there's less oxygen in the ocean, which means there's less oxygen to support fish. So the fish stocks are dropping. But when you got a temperature of 21 degrees, you're not going to have a lot of fish in the oceans to start with. So in one sense, already there is the extinction of life forms taking place even before the catastrophe, because of the fact that the ocean water was about 6 degrees warmer than it is right now. And then with the catastrophe, it jumped up to 35 degrees, 95 degrees Fahrenheit. And when that happens, not only do you get a sea level rise, the oceans become more acidic and the oxygen disappears. So there's no oxygen. So that kills off all the life forms in the oceans that need oxygen. What they are able to document is 95% of all species of life in the oceans went extinct. And it's the biggest extinction event we can measure in the history of the Earth. There may have been bigger ones earlier, but it's too far back to get good data. But 95%. And a lot of it was caused by the fact there was no oxygen for these animals in the oceans to breathe. And then you have what's called an H2S event, hydrogen sulfide, rotten egg gas. I think you've all smelled hydrogen sulfide. It's not a pleasant odor. It's amazing how little hydrogen sulfide needs to be in this room for everybody to be really noticing that it's there. Just the tiniest amount, and you'll notice that it's there. God gave us a nose that's very sensitive to hydrogen sulfide for a good reason. It's deadly. It's very toxic. And so our noses, fortunately, are sensitive enough that we spot it right away and we run away. It's not a pleasant odor. So we get away, and that protects us. But with the oxygen being depleted from the ocean, it causes massive blooms of bacteria that produce hydrogen sulfide. And so right after the catastrophe, you get all these bacteria. So not all life went extinct. All the animals that needed oxygen went extinct. The animals that produced hydrogen sulfide were thriving very well. And so they were pumping all this hydrogen sulfide into the ocean and all this hydrogen sulfide into the atmosphere, and it basically killed off all the animals on the continents and in the oceans. Because, you know, they... In fact, this is the only mass extinction event we can measure that wiped out even things like cockroaches. The insects were wiped out. Yeah, we could have an all-out nuclear war and the cockroaches would do just fine. They would not be impacted unless they're right at the blast site. But yeah, thanks to this huge pumping of hydrogen sulfide in the atmosphere, it actually drove to extinction all the insect species on the continental land masses. As far as the continents go, they weren't hit quite as bad. But 90% of all species of life on the continents were driven to extinction. 95% in the oceans were driven to extinction. And thanks to the volcanic eruptions and wildfires erupted all over the planet, so all the grass got burnt, all the forests got burnt, it even ignited the coal beds. So if we go back to this thing here, a lot of coal was laid down in the Carboniferous. And the end of the Permian, all that coal was laid down, a whole lot of it got ignited and was burning. So it was all this smoke and ash going into the atmosphere. Yes?
You mentioned the Permian extinction also wiped out the insects, but wait a minute. The Cambrian explosion, I thought, occurred before land.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the Cambrian here.
Right. Okay.
And so you got insects coming in here.
Oh, right in there.
Yeah. But they got wiped out by all the disaster that happened. Yes.
Okay, so the oceans obviously cooled off because we had God create animal life and dinosaurs emerged. Can you comment on that process and how long it took?
Okay. You can get Improbable Planet. You got the book?
Yeah.
What I do, because that's a very common question. And so as I talk to you about each of these geologic periods, I tell you how much oxygen is in the atmosphere and how much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
So it comes back to that, right?
Yeah, because that's the primary change that's taking place here. After each mass extinction event, the chemistry of the atmosphere has changed. and this permits different kinds of life to exist.
Yeah.
So life that was thriving on one chemical environment now gets replaced by life that's surviving in a slightly different chemical environment.
So that's kind of how God divided the days with this oxygen thing, perhaps part of it?
Well, for example, between creation day 4 and creation day 5, the oxygen goes from 1% up to 8%. And then as we go into the birds and sea life forms, that's when the oxygen content goes from about 10% up to about 20%. Because, yeah, birds and mammals, they need a lot more oxygen than fish
and
lizards.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Cool.
Okay. Cool, but it wasn't so cool during this period. So. Yeah, this is by far the worst of the catastrophes that have happened in the past half billion years. And also because it was warming up so much, it melted all the clathrates. You know what clathrates are? They're frozen chunks of carbon dioxide. And so if you go up to Alaska or northern Canada or down to Antarctica, you'll find these huge deposits of clathrates. In fact, what's really cool is to watch somebody taking a block of ice and lighting a match to it, and it burns. A frozen block of ice will burn. And what it is, it's frozen water encapsulating carbon dioxide.
Methane.
Yeah, it's methane, not carbon dioxide. It's methane. Yeah, so that's what clathrate is. It's methane trapped inside of water ice. And there's a huge store on the planet right now of clathrates. Underneath the ocean beds, huge deposits of clathrates. Up in the Arctic and the Antarctic, again, huge deposits of clathrates. It's not a problem because it's cold. If, as long as you've got high pressure, like what you have below the seafloor, the clathrates are stable. And as long as it's cold, the clathrates are stable. But what happened during the Permian-Triassic catastrophe is the planet warmed so much, it basically melted those blocks of water ice and caused all that methane to pump into the atmosphere. And that explains why the temperature jumped up to such an extreme degree. Incidentally, the air temperature would have been even higher. That's the seawater temperature. And so in terms of the continents, they're looking at hundreds of degrees and hotter. So again, that was another factor responsible for the extinction of all these animals. And then to cap it all off, you've got Pangaea splitting up. Because if you go back to the Permian event, this is when you've got one gigantic continent on the face of the Earth. But at the end of the Permian, we have Pangaea splitting into two continents. And as you go on, it eventually splits into seven, actually eight. There's seven continents on the planet right now, and if you go back to the Neogene, there are actually eight continents. The Indian subcontinent was an eighth continent, and it joined with Asia during the Neogene realm. So, okay, the paper. The paper basically is making the point that we need to change everything in the sense that what's been in the literature until the day after Valentine's Day was that there was no recovery of life on planet Earth until we went from literally 10 million years. So during this whole period, there really wasn't much life on planet Earth. Bacteria, yes, but not much else until 242 million years ago. And what the paper is telling us is that we need to push that back. That in fact, let me go this way. Here we go. There. So instead of it taking 10 million years for the ecosystem of the Earth to recover, it recovers in just 1.3 million years. So, and all because somebody did some digging around in southeastern Idaho. And they just found these. Well, what they found was a place where there was massive flooding and mud deposits taking place, just like you did at the beginning of the Cambrian explosion. The reason why we have such a good record of the Cambrian explosion is because there was a, you know, literally worldwide, we have these massive floods and mud pouring down and basically trapping all these animals and fossilizing them. Well, they found a place in Idaho where likewise they were able to find a catastrophic flood event that wound up fossilizing a bunch of animals. And basically the big discovery is it didn't take 10 million years, it happened in just 1.3 million years. And when you read the paper, the language is one of utter shock and surprise. How can we possibly get this diversity of life, as complex as it is, with such an incredibly complete ecosystem happening that fast after such a massive catastrophe in the face of the Earth? That's the bottom line of the paper. Yes?
So you're saying that there was a complete extinction event, and 1.3 million years after that, there was a complete ecosystem?
Well, a complete ecosystem where they could measure it. They're basically saying that we were lucky enough in Idaho to find a place where we had animals that were fossilized at that time. The paper ends by saying, we need to look at a whole bunch of other places.
Doesn't that pretty much put an end to evolution?
Well, that's kind of the comments that you see in the paper. And the paper is written by 18 evolutionists, and they're sticking to their story. But I'm gonna pull some quotes from you out of the paper, which is basically telling you they're sticking to their story, but they're really shocked by what they're finding because it doesn't fit their story. So that's kind of what's going on here. In fact, I'll jump to, okay. The other thing that stunned them about this deposit they found in southeastern Idaho, we're basically looking at benthic ecosystem. So we're looking at the life forms that exist at the bottom of the seafloor. They don't have anything else there. They said, we were very lucky in the sense that we have this massive flood that was able to give us a look at this one ecosystem on planet Earth. Now, there's some talk in the paper that because we're looking at animals that existed on the bottom of the seafloor, they may have been a little more protected from the aftermath of this catastrophe. But yeah, 1.3 million years is not a lot of time to recover from a catastrophe of this magnitude. With all that happening, people were saying, yeah, it's reasonable we don't see anything for 10 million years because that's how long it's going to take the planet to recover. This new study is basically saying the planet recovered a whole lot faster than what we presumed. Yes? That's exactly the critique. If it's happening that fast, we should be able to see it in real time.
So the cockroaches and the fish came back just in that 1.3 million years?
Well, they found a complete ecosystem. We're talking vertebrates. And what really surprised them is that they found a whole ecosystem of predators. Their anticipation is, given the magnitude of the Permian-Triassic catastrophe, we're probably only going to be finding some scavengers and herbivores. But what they write in the paper is, number one, we found a whole lot of species of predators that measure between half a foot and a foot in length. So these are fairly big animals. But he says, more than that, we found fossil evidence of predators that feed on the middle-sized predators. So they're basically saying we see the whole range of herbivores, scavengers, parasites, as well as carnivores of all different sizes. And so they said, we're actually looking at a complete ecosystem here. And it's already in balance, it's already optimized, and it's happening just 1.3 million years after the event. Yes, and then back to you.
So just three things. I contacted Trinity College in London. They do a lot of work on extinction events. I said, did any of the dinosaurs, even small ones especially, come through the Permian Cretacic? And they say, yes, we have evidence of that. That's number one, that they do not agree with a complete extinction. And then theologically on Psalms 104:30 about renewing the face of the earth, the powerful word there is bara, to create or to separate. Just two chapters back in 102:18, it uses the word bara. This shall be written for the generation to come, and the people which shall be bara created shall praise the Lord. So there's talking about generations using the bara. So it's not something new out of nothing, and especially for the people. And then the last thing is, we assume it atheistic extinction event because we say, well, evolution should be going on today. Well, that's atheistic, not theistic. Theistic would say God created and he's not creating anymore. So the true evolution is not being.
Yeah, we're going to get into all that, Steve, because I'm going to show you some of the comments in the paper. And yeah, you are right. They are claiming that it wasn't a total extinction event.
Right.
There were a few survivors. But there's some serious challenges to that point of view that I'll get to.
I can't stay. I have to leave at 10 after.
Not a problem.
But I found the paper.
Okay, you found the paper. Good. I was going to give you the title. It's got 18 authors.
I think I found the paper. Give me the title.
It's in Science Advances. That'll help you find it right away. Just go to Science Advances. And I'll give you the title. And, you know, scientists love long titles. Unexpected Early Triassic Marine Ecosystem and the Rise of Modern Evolutionary Fauna. So that's the title of the paper. But, you know, what's really interesting is rarely do they ever put a word like unexpected in there, but that was the first word, unexpected early Triassic marine ecosystem. And, yeah, what shocked them is how complete the ecosystem was and how incredibly early it shows up right after the disaster. And the other thing that surprised them was just how many different species that they found. They found 7 phyla and over 20 orders of these benthic creatures. And they said, we're still continuing the collections. We think we're going to find a lot more. But it says, even the fact that we found 7 phyla and over 20 orders, that's astounding, given how little time we're talking about from the mass extinction event until we see all these creatures. Here's some quotes I pulled from the paper. They refer to this as an intense morphological diversification. Morphology refers to the body structure, the body plans of these animals. They also notice we're not just seeing great diversity, we're seeing great abundance. They said, look at all the fossils we found in this little one area. So he says, we're not just talking great diversity. Evidently, the planet was just packed with life. And he said, it's packed with life just 1.3 million years after this greatest extinction event ever. And then they wind up in their last paragraph saying, they, referring to the fossils, indicate an independent evolution of these clades from a still unknown late Paleozoic common ancestor. So here they are trying to defend their evolutionary paradigm, saying, we know evolution is right, so there's got to be a common ancestor. We haven't found it yet. It's unknown, but it must have happened. And what really threw them is that they found what they call Lazarus taxa. And that's a term that's been in the evolutionary literature literally for decades. And it refers to a species of life that goes away, goes extinct, and then it comes back exactly in the form that it was.
They got that from the Bible.
They got that from the Bible, right. So it was so, such a compelling thing, analogy, that they used the biblical term. You remember Lazarus in the book of John, a friend of Jesus who died and 4 days later came back to life. And so that's something that's been puzzling paleontologists, how we find these species of life that literally disappear and reappear in exactly the same form. Now, being evolutionary biologists, what they say is, yeah, we have found these Lazarus taxa. We don't think they really went extinct. What happened was their population collapsed to such a low degree that we can't find them in the fossil record. And then when conditions get optimal, they come back. They begin to multiply. So they're not really claiming that they're true Lazarus taxa. They're holding to their guns the fact that, hey, it was simply a drop in the population. However, this is the first time I've seen a Lazarus taxon discovered with an enormous time gap between the last appearance and the next appearance. In this case, it's 200 million years. And so this now becomes a challenge. How do you explain the fact that it's missing from the fossil record for 200 million years? Okay, if you're going to claim the population dropped to a low level and stayed that low for 200 million years, what happens when a species of life has a population collapse for a long period of time? They go extinct. If you look at conservation biology studies, in fact, we see that all over the planet today. We talk about endangered species, where the population drops to such a low level, if we human beings don't intervene, the species rapidly goes extinct. So the idea that it could survive without any intervention for 200 million years, or to claim we've got no fossil evidence, it is true the fossil record's not complete. But if you're going to claim that you have an incompleteness for 200 million years, it's not that bad. Yeah, we got gaps where we don't have good fossilization events, but they don't last 200 million years. So I think what they've documented in their paper is indeed a true Lazarus taxon. And we're talking about a complex sponge animal that existed during the Cambrian explosion, went extinct, and it shows up just 1.3 million years after the Permian-Triassic event. Okay, lots of questions, so yeah, go ahead.
Two things. One, the dinosaurs started to appear on the scene at least at any kind of degree. How many years after the beginning of the Triassic did they appear? Yeah. And number two, even if it were 10 million years, wouldn't that violate all sorts of mathematical evidence on genetic change? Even 10 million years would blow them out of the water, one would think.
Okay, well, the answer to your question is dinosaurs start showing up 10 to 20 million years after the Permian-Triassic catastrophe. Now, there's some speculation that maybe they were really tiny dinosaurs, like a couple of inches high. However, this is going to be a problem now because we have these benthic life forms that show up 1.3 million years after the Permian-Triassic event. If you're going to speculate that there is these little dinosaurs running around, how come we got no fossils? So the dinosaurs don't show up at the beginning of the Triassic. You got to go in 10 to 20 million years before they start showing up.
And they're big?
Well, they become big fairly quickly, yeah. And so that was consistent with the story, because the whole story was, well, except for microbes, nothing exists until 10 million years later. And that's when the dinosaurs show up. So it's like, okay, that's when everything starts to happen. But now we got to push it back by more than 8 million years.
How can scientists even put any kind of faith in 10 million years? That's just way too short a period of time, as you well know.
Well, right now I'm involved in a Four Views book on creation evolution, and the individual representing the theistic evolution perspective is claiming that whales are an example of natural process evolution. It's similar to the dinosaur problem. These are not small animals, they're big animals. They're coming in at, 10 to 100 tons. The blue whale weighs in at, 200,000 pounds. And you're trying to say that these animals rapidly evolve. Well, it's a principle in evolutionary biology. The larger the adult body size, the slower the evolutionary change, and the higher the likelihood that the creature will go extinct before it evolves at all. In fact, a couple of studies are showing, if you're talking about mammals, which a whale is a mammal, once the adult body size gets bigger than 7 pounds, it will go extinct before it evolves into a distinctly different species. And yet whales are being promoted as the best example we have of natural process evolution. Now, they are correct. If you look at the fossil record, we see like 60 different species of whales over the past 60 million years. And we actually see them progressing from being freshwater only to being in the estuaries, to being along the seashores, to coming in the oceans. So you do see that progression. But what's also interesting is about 40 million years ago is that you just see an explosion of whale diversity. They go from being close to the seashores to being everywhere with every imaginable design feature you see in the whales today. They show up all at once. It's explosive. And it's explosive for creatures that are really big. You know, if you're talking about animals that can evolve efficiently, bacteria are at the top of the list. They're the most efficient evolvers. They got a tiny body size. They reproduce in 20 minutes. A whale takes several years to reproduce, so you got a long generation time, which means you don't have as many opportunities for mutations and natural selection. Whales don't exchange genes like bacteria do, so that's another knockout against the evolutionary paradigm. They have very few progeny per adult, so you don't have a lot. Like insects have lots of progeny, mice have lots of progeny. They're going to be more efficient evolvers. If you look at whales and the large dinosaurs, they're going to be the least efficient evolving creatures that have ever existed on the planet. Because of their enormous body size, long generation time, the amount of food they have to consume, and how few progeny they have per adult. And also, they tend to be very subject to environmental stress. The bigger you are, the more subject you are to changes in the environment.
Where I'm going with that, take example, protein has 150 amino acids. That's a relatively simple protein. You go up to over 1,000, as you well know. To mathematically, on a random basis, to get that one simple protein, 150 amino acids, if you assume 1 trillion chemical interactions per second, it would take you a universe 100 billion times 30 billion years with that one simple protein. So how in the world do they expect the diversification of life to occur within 10 million years?
Okay, I would encourage you to be cautious with that argument. Mm-hmm. This is actually part of the debate I'm having in this Four Views book, because someone from the intelligent design movement is really promoting this argument about the improbability of getting proteins over a short period of time. Mm-hmm. What's countering that in the scientific literature is that they're realizing that the protein space is heavily packed with functional proteins compared to non-functional proteins, which means the probabilities are still remote, but they're nowhere near as remote as what people from, say, the Discovery Institute are claiming. And that's causing people to discount the protein evolution argument. It's still a good argument, but it's far more complicated than it's been made to believe. I say that because a lot of lay Christians are using the argument, and it blows up once they encounter someone who's actually a biochemist.
By a factor of what? Let's say you reduce it by 100 billion times, you're still down to 30 billion. I mean, what's the magnitude?
Okay, that's the problem. The argument is still valid, but yeah, the reduction in the probability, you're literally knocking off 10, 20, 30 zeros. Now, even if you knock off 10, 20, 30 zeros, you still got a good argument. However, I wouldn't use the argument because how many zeros we can actually knock off hasn't been determined yet in the scientific literature. We know we can get rid of a lot of zeros. We know we can't get rid of them all. But before I would use the argument on a trained biochemist, I want to have better data than we have right now. But one thing I can tell you is, my peers who are biochemists in the research community are very upset at the Christian argument that's being promoted because they said it's widely exaggerated. But you got a point. Take away the exaggeration, the argument still holds. What I'm arguing in this Four Views book, we Christians have much easier, less complex arguments to present that are far more potent and are well backed up by the secular scientific literature. So I'm basically saying, let's put the information argument on hold. Let's put the protein argument on hold. We'll come back to that. Instead, we're going to use these arguments. And my whole point in this book is you want to use arguments that secular, unbelieving research scientists acknowledge as real arguments that have potency. For example, the fact that you don't even have the building blocks. So I don't have to get into the probability argument if the building blocks don't exist. And so, in terms of the origin of life, we know we have no natural source for the ribose sugars that are crucial for making the amino or the DNA and the RNA. If you don't have ribose, you're never going to get DNA or RNA. And three of the crucial amino acids are missing. There's no arginine, there's no tryptophan, and there's no alanine. Those are missing. We don't see them anywhere in the universe, and we don't see them anywhere here on the Earth. and we see no evidence they could have been here any earlier. So, however, a caveat. I've been on records predicting we are going to find those building blocks. Why? Because we know from the measurements we've already done in these dense molecular clouds, the chemical pathways that make these molecules do operate. The problem is there's other chemical pathways that destroy them as fast as they're being made. And so I've been on record as predicting we will eventually find them at a few parts per billion. Because all they've been able to do is look for them at, say, about 100 parts per billion. We know that they're not that abundant. And we're talking a few parts per billion. That's of no value to any naturalistic origin of life model. They have to have them at parts per thousand or better, and we're nowhere close to that. So, but again, it'd be a mistake to say we're never going to find those molecules. We will find them, but they're right now we don't have the telescope power to detect them. Eventually, we will. The new generation of telescopes should be powerful enough to detect them. But we're again talking such underabundance that it's of no value. And incidentally, we do find them a few parts per billion. It's going to confirm that they're being destroyed as rapidly as they're being made. And that's going to be a problem on the early Earth just as well. I mean, if the lifetimes of your building block molecules are minutes rather than millions of years, you're in trouble for your model.
This is the last question that I need to give you a summation, please.
Okay, go ahead.
That and norms of the speculation of genetic drift versus the established observations of changes outside the normal things that occur in reproduction, just evaluating the whole current scientific database we have for things, you wind up with a picture in the conclusion of a species population that should be much, much, much more dense. As in, there should be human-like creatures that we can't make it, and lots of them. And there should be things between things that aren't there in the current species population.
Well, what we are seeing right now, if we go back to this diagram here, is the number of distinct species on the planet consistently goes up as you go through this period, where if you go back 200 million years ago, we hit a maximum. So isn't it interesting that the maximum number of species that have ever existed on the planet is in the human era? And so, again, as part of God's provision, we have 8.6 million species of eukaryotic life forms on planet Earth today. We've never had a number that high in the pre-human eras. So again, it's evidence that God was preparing everything, giving us the biodeposits and giving us the different species of life. You know, I had no idea that it was taking this much time to go through this discovery. So I'm going to start with our Bible lesson next week. I'll skip a scientific discovery. However, I do want to read for you a few more comments in the conclusion of this paper. These are direct quotes. It says, much more phylogenetic diverse and functionally much more complex than we ever considered possible. The oldest occurrence of derived characters in several clades. So it's basically pushing back the introduction of new species of life much earlier in time. And says, what we've discovered in southeastern Idaho includes newly evolved groups. And they refer to their study as a new landmark for understanding the marine recovery dynamics after the end Permian mass extinction. It stands in stark contrast with previous works that suggested a sluggish recovery and a low diversity of marine organisms. That was the party line until just a few days ago. And it's a party line that fits very well with an evolutionary paradigm. Given the magnitude of the Triassic catastrophe, you'd expect a very gradual, sluggish recovery of these complex life forms on planet Earth. But this paper is documenting as something that none of the evolutionists expected, is how quickly it happened, and when it did happen, just how complex and diverse and how complete the ecosystem was. What we see, and again, this is a pattern that I think you see in all the mass extinction events. After every mass extinction event, you get a mass speciation event, and when you look at the fossils in the mass speciation event, you see an optimized ecology. All evolutionary models predict tens of millions of years, if not hundreds of millions of years, for the ecological relationships to become optimized. What we see in the fossil record is the opposite. Optimization happens immediately. And what does that tell you about what's responsible for these mass speciation events? And again, in the context of what's happening to the physics of the sun, you're going to want a rapid replacement of life. You don't want to wait long. If you wait too long, you're going to get out of sync with what's happening with the sun. So you'd expect the creator that knows what's happening in the physics of the sun to quickly replace the life that has been removed with life forms that have an optimal ecological relationship, which means you got the best possible balance between herbivores and carnivores and detrivores, which are the ones that take care of the dead creatures, and the parasites. And that's what was stunning to these researchers. It happens right away. Rather than seeing a gradual optimization, it's there right away. And it's happening as soon as conditions of the Earth would allow it to happen. But again, that's what you'd expect from a God that's making sure we don't get out of sync with the physics of the sun, and is also making certain that we as rapidly as possible prepare the planet for human beings. Now, I use that word rapid, but 3.8 billion years is an incredibly short period of time to build up the resources that humans need to launch and sustain civilization. And again, that's the message of my book, Improbable Planet, is how incredibly aggressive the creator was to get it all in place in only 3.8 billion years. So that's the advantage of being an old Earth creationist. You can talk about that as being something that's really quick and rapid. But yeah, I mean, if you actually look at the physics behind it, you only got 9 zeros to work with. And look at all you got to accomplish in just a few billion years. So hopefully all this geology didn't give you a headache. And hopefully you'll go away today, hey, rejoicing with the fact that, hey, look what God did to make sure that we human beings have all the wealth and resources we need to fulfill the Great Commission. That was our sermon today, is that God has given us everything we need to go out and make disciples of all peoples. God has literally been preparing the planet for 3.8 billion years, so you're going to have everything you need to share your faith and bring people to into a discipleship relationship with Jesus Christ. And given what's happening to the physics of the sun, we need to do this quickly. We really are at the end of the line for life on planet Earth. But that's one of the blessings. God put us at the end so we could have the maximum wealth and resources to do what God has asked us to do. And so next week, I want to talk to you about a book that got published Friday. It's been on the bestseller list for a month. Everybody's been anticipating this book. And the title of the book is Homo Deus. And it's written by a Jewish historian, very famous fellow. And he's basically making the claim, we human beings are on our way to becoming God. Okay, we're going to do it. And we're going to overcome all these problems that are facing us. And so I'm going to kind of put you on the spot next week, and I'm going to allow you to critique the book as to not only why are we not going to become gods, but also no matter what we do in terms of technological achievement, we're not going to be able to live on this planet much longer. The days of human existence on planet Earth are going to quickly end. Now, again, I'm an astronomer. When I say quickly, I'm not talking tomorrow, okay? But literally, we're talking probably a few thousand years maximum, maybe only a few centuries before the end of human, because eventually, with the physics of the sun, all life will go extinct. The sun's going to be too hot for any life to exist. Because what we've been doing is pulling greenhouses out of the greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere. We're already at the low end of the greenhouse gases necessary to sustain life. During the last ice age, the carbon dioxide level almost got down to the point of halting all photosynthesis. We're only a few parts per million away from that disaster happening. When the next ice age hits, it's almost certain we're going to dip below that level. And that will be a mass extinction event that will be equivalent to what happened during the Permian Triassic. So we're that close. And see, in order to compensate for the increasing brightness of the sun, you've got to pull more greenhouse gases of the atmosphere. But if you draw any more carbon dioxide of the atmosphere, photosynthesis ceases. And hey, when you have lunch today, remember what you're eating on your plate, it's all due to photosynthesis. No photosynthesis, no meat, no vegetables, no grains, nothing. So might want to think about that. So I've given you reasons to be depressed. I've also given you reasons to be really joyous. So with that, let me pray. Father in heaven, we thank you for the fact that we are at the end. And because we're at the end, we have the blessing of all these riches and resources that we can use to fulfill your purpose. And Lord, we thank you that we have the promise in your book of Scripture that there's a new creation that will follow this creation. And as soon as we humans here on earth that are followers of your creator, your creation, that we will exit this creation and enter the new creation. Thank you for all the preparation you've done on our behalf, Lord. I pray that we would use the time that you've given us wisely. And Lord, help us to see each one of us the individual role and purpose that we can fulfill in making possible our movement from this creation to the new creation. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Thank you.